You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Attorney General William Barr said the Mueller report confirms that President Trump committed no collusion with Russia, but did not reach a conclusion on whether Trump obstructed justice. We'll discuss the release of today's redacted report and what happens now. First, abusive relationships and dating violence aren't just a problem for adults. Teenagers are also at risk. A new study from the University of Washington finds that between 2003 and 2016, 7% of teenage homicide victims were killed by their former or current intimate partners. 90% of those victims were female. Experts say that educating kids early on about respectful relationships and seeing them modeled by adults are important steps to keep dating safe. And a Wisconsin organization has been getting teenagers themselves involved in reaching out to their peers to prevent abuse. Stephanie Ortiz is the Director of Prevention and Outreach with End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Cody Warner is the LGBTQ and Youth Program Director at End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. He's with us here in the studio. Cody, thanks for being here.
Yes, it's really awesome to be here.
Stephanie, let's start with you. What does the scope of dating violence for teens look like in Wisconsin?
Thanks for having me on, y'all. We know that 1 in 5 teens experience dating violence in Wisconsin. And then some national statistics I still think are prevalent here, in that 2 in 3 teens never tell anyone about it when they are in those unhealthy relationships. And then with the devices nowadays, 1 in 4 teens say they've been called names, harassed, or put down by their partner through mobile devices. So that sheds a little bit of light on the prevalence, and I'm sure Cody could say more.
And just to reiterate, you said that as many as 1 in 5, so 20% of teens, have experienced some type of violence in their dating relationships.
Correct. And that's Wisconsin specific.
And Cody, did you want to add something?
Yeah. End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin has a homicide report that they produce annually. And we've been going through that. And since 2000, there have been 30 teens in Wisconsin that have been lost to dating violence homicides.
And I have to say, I think that often when we hear the term domestic violence, or even if you hear dating violence, people tend to think of adults. Mm-hmm. But this is something that is clearly affecting a lot of young people, Cody.
Definitely. And that's one of the reasons that we are pushing so hard to bring light, to inspire, to illuminate, to educate folks on this statewide.
Stephanie, you mentioned that I believe you said 2/3 of teens who have been in a violent relationship or an abusive relationship haven't told anyone about it. Do we know what some of the reasons are that keep them from reaching out for help?
I mean, the infamous one is not being believed, right, by the loving folks in your life. And so one way that we try to get around that in the work that we're doing at the State Coalition with Teens is really encouraging young people to be that trusted person in their friends' lives. So we're really encouraging teens to develop the tools, equip them with the tools so that they're feeling ready to respond to their friends when they're in situations like this, or they're able to recognize it earlier on, because teens are more likely to tell their peers about this rather than the adults in their lives.
And we'll definitely talk about the program that End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin has to use these teen ambassadors. Cody, one of the things I was thinking about in preparing for this is that I can see a lot of reasons why a young person might have additional barriers to asking for help, one of which is a lot of times young people are not supposed to be dating. Like mm-hmm. their parents might have said, you're not going out with anyone until mm-hmm. you're 16. Well, maybe they're 15 and they are dating someone and it's not a healthy relationship. But, you know, especially to a young person's mind, kind of outing themselves as being in a mm-hmm. relationship might seem like it's not worth the risk.
You're right. And that number that I mentioned before, that those 30 teens lost, those are just the ones that were reported. A lot of times the families don't know that they're dating, don't know that they're in this relationship, which is why we really try and focus on that like peer-to-peer model, because we know that teens are going to their friends first, mm-hmm. if at all. And those barriers just beyond not even being able to date, but you know, access to services in general are often limited by what they can actually either afford, not be on their parents' insurance, if they're just trying to get initial help.
Mm-hmm. And Cody, what are some of the additional obstacles for teens who might be, say, in a same-sex relationship?
I mean, it's a lot more difficult because there's a lot less resources in Wisconsin, especially in the more rural areas. There might not even be a GSA at their school. And a lot of
Straight Alliance.
Correct. And a lot of those youth that I've worked with, that folks around the state have worked with, have said that we don't really know what a healthy relationship is. So how are we supposed to know what an unhealthy relationship looks like?
We're talking with Cody Warner and Stephanie Ortiz. They are both with End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. We're talking about the risks to teens and young people in dating violence and how lethal it can actually be in those intimate relationships. And I want to talk specifically about the program that you have that that really uses those peers, as you said, Cody, to provide information, support, resources to fellow teens. How are you recruiting teens to work in that?
Yeah. So in 2014, we started our statewide teen council. And so we have a northern and southern teen council, and it's expanded a lot since the beginning. And we're now close to over 100 people within it. And those are adults and teens doing prevention-like work around anti-oppression and dating violence and gender-based violence in their communities already. So that was our really awesome, really big pool of teens and adult mentors that we had in the state.
And Stephanie, what are you learning from these teens who are involved? I mean, it would be, I think, easy. And it's pretty common for adults to think like, oh, well, you know, I've got all this life experience. I'm going to say what teens need. What are you hearing from the teens themselves?
I mean, I'm hearing teens really talk about, you know, the facts that we're sharing today really don't shed light on the actual prevalence. The teens are telling us that they don't know any of their friends that haven't been impacted by dating violence, right? So, I mean, that I think is telling about the resources that are going to be necessary in order to really prevent this from ever happening or even being thought about as a way to resolve a situation, right? And so our young people are feeling like they need more tools. They want to have teen dating violence and healthy relationships talked about in different spaces outside of the ones that we're creating for them. So they're really wanting to see more of the education, show up in the schools, show up in different community centers that they're part of, really expanding the spaces that we create for them out in their community in other ways. So just feeling like more resources need to be directed towards preventing violence from ever happening.
And Stephanie, it does seem like having done some domestic violence training in the past, it can be very tempting to tell someone who we feel is being victimized in a relationship, you just need to do this, whether it's you need to break up with that person, you need to move out, you need to do this. But really, it needs to be that person's decision. How do you talk with teens who might want to just, you know, insert themselves and say to their friends, look, this is what you need to do, period, end of sentence?
Ooh, that I really try to encourage them to be conscious about telling someone to leave an abusive relationship, because we know that's the most dangerous time. You know, we talk about the statistics of homicides happening right after a breakup and it being a really high percentage. And so we're really careful about telling teens to leave abusive relationships. We're really careful about taking the time to give them safety planning processes that they can go through, because it's really a long process and a lot of things go into leaving an abusive relationship. It's not just a quick end and done and leave.
And Cody, it seems like there are a lot of things that can happen in relationships that can be seen as proof that your partner really cares about you, when in fact, if you look at it through kind of a lens of power and control, they're not healthy behaviors. Can you share some of those with us, and you know how that can be hard to show someone, you know, this doesn't mean that this person loves you actually.
So a lot of times it'll come up as like small comments about like what they're wearing, and then eventually it kind of like will increase in like controlling where they will get physically or verbally angry at them and start yelling or telling them what not to wear and what not to wear. There can still be financial abuse happening between them and controlling that person's money that they get either through allowance or their jobs, and controlling what they can and can't spend money on. And, you know, slowly isolating those teens away from their friends, family, and other support systems that they already have, because, you know, that whole infatuation beginning of the relationship, it's so new. You just want to be together and like get to know each other really well. And in reality, if healthy relationships, it's really nice to have that and still time for you and your support systems that are involved.
We're talking with Cody Warner and Stephanie Ortiz from End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, and we're looking at the issue of dating violence among teenagers. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think teenagers need to know about having safe, healthy relationships? Did you have a relationship when you were young that you now see was problematic? What advice did you get or not get as a teenager when it came to dating? And did the relationships you saw around you as a young person affect your approach to dating? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Cody Warner and Stephanie Ortiz from End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. We're looking at the issue of dating violence among teenagers and how to prevent it. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you wish you knew about having healthy relationships when you were younger? How did the relationships you saw around you affect the way you interacted with your partners? And if you're a teenager now, do you think your friends know enough about how to be safe and respectful in their relationships? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Stephanie, about a year ago, End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin launched Dare to Know, which has a component of a teen ambassador program. Tell us how that works. What do those teen ambassadors do?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So our teen ambassador program is fairly new. We actually are holding monthly virtual meetups, which allow for our teens that are separated across the state to really come together and build connectedness and share ways that they can promote the campaign, which is all about healthy relationships and healing, on their social media platforms. So it's really social media focused, because we know that young people who have access to their media devices are turning them on immediately when they wake up. So we're using social media as the platform to get out the word about the Dare to Know campaign, and we're really encouraging teens to persuade their peers to tap in. So we're really trying to build up these young people to a point where they're feeling confident to relay the messages in their community, get their peers involved, and eventually even hold panels and like different sorts of, we're doing a school tour coming this year. So it's really all about equipping the young people with the tools necessary to promote the campaign in their local areas.
Let's go to the phones, and Jessica in Green Bay is up. Hi, Jessica.
Hello.
Hi. Jessica, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, yep, I'm here.
Go ahead. So I just wanted to call in because I have an experience I'd like to share. My mother was taken at the hands of domestic violence in 2013, and I really just wanted to reinforce what Stephanie was saying about, you know, not always just jumping right into, oh, you need to leave that person, you know, you need to break up with them, and just really making sure that that person has a game plan, so to speak, about how to safely exit that relationship. So again, just making sure that you have a support group around you, you have people who, you know, even could physically be there to protect you, back you up when you do decide to leave that person. Because, you know, things with my mom may have gone differently if she would have had an exit plan planned out.
Jessica, I'm so very sorry for that tragic loss. And yes, Stephanie, you had made a point of saying that the most dangerous time in a violent relationship is often when someone's trying to leave.
Yes, absolutely. And that, to just reiterate your point, that's the importance of having a support network and a game plan, just like you mentioned. There's so many factors that go into why folks stay in a relationship, and oftentimes it's centering their safety. And so having a plan in place is still very important.
And Cody, obviously, it can be challenging for anyone to be able to put together a safety plan, but especially for someone who is a minor who may or may not feel like they can talk to their parents. Is part of the teen peer program encouraging them to find at least a safe adult, even if it's not a parent?
Yes, the whole process is about valuing your voice, persuading your peers, and connecting with community. And our main thing with connecting with community is finding those adult mentors within your area. And so we're also working on finding those agencies, those adults in different areas of the state to faster connect those teens with an adult mentor.
And Cody, do you feel like there is a growing awareness on the part of, say, teachers or administrators or leaders of faith communities that teen dating violence is a very serious issue to deal with?
I think it's slowly getting there. That's definitely why we're really pushing this first leg of the campaign, to really bring that awareness to people, to make sure that all the adults know that this is happening, whether you are choosing to believe it or not, and letting folks know where those resources are.
Let's go back to the phones, and Aiden in Rice Lake is up next. Hi, Aiden.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I've been listening to the conversation, and I really appreciate and think it's important that we take this time to talk about how we can prevent dating violence in our own lives and in the lives of youth and others. As well as supports and resources and tools for folks who are experiencing it. At the same time, I wonder what would happen if we shifted this framework a little bit to shift our attention to people who commit acts of dating violence and sort of the root causes of that, and what creates the conditions that someone feels so powerful to, you know, or takes the power, you know, over somebody else. And what would happen if we started looking at that a little bit more, and how we can prevent folks from committing these acts and becoming violent or abusive?
That's a great question, Aiden. Thank you for that. And so, Stephanie, is there a two-pronged approach where you are hoping to reach people who are victims in these relationships, but what about trying to interrupt and correct the behavior of the abusers?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need to take both approaches, certainly. And one way that I try to explain this to young people is I really talk about the dynamic of oppression and the way that we come into the world as babies, right? Like, as babies, we come into this world kind and loving and zestful and proud. And we're equipped at birth with natural processes to resolve conflict that comes up in the world, whether it's talking it out, crying it out, taking time to go get some exercise and just de-stressing. We actually have natural ways to resolving conflict in nonviolent ways, but it's the society and the world and the adults that are in our lives that are really sending us conflicting messages. So one thing that I like to teach my young people is start being critical of the music that you're listening to. That puts over-sexualizing and objectifying women, like, those messages are going to permeate into your behavior eventually. So it's really about trying to change the new normal and really talk about healthy relationships in a way in which, you know, it can be modeled and seen in your community. And so it's really important to engage adults and make sure that they're modeling healthy behaviors, so that those that are coming after them are really having a model of what to look up to and how to even resolve conflict in a nonviolent way.
Thanks for that call, Aiden. Let's go back to the phones, and Emilio is in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Emilio.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was listening with my mother, and I was hoping to talk about or just briefly say my experience with Daredevil. Mm-hmm. I went to the teen summit a while back, and it really taught me about teen relationships. Like, it helped, it opened up my eyes, so I could see that most people around my school didn't know anything about this, and it was important to get the topic out so people weren't committing horrible actions against their significant others. And after going to Dare to Know and the Teen Summit, a couple of friends that went with me, we were so inspired that we started a relationship education group here in Sturgeon Bay called FIRE, and it stands for Forging Youth Relationship Education.
That's great, Emilio. And what's the response been from your peers?
It's been very inviting. They like to see that they're not alone, where that there's other people that have experienced teen relationship issues, and that we have this group now, and it's letting them come together and talk about how people have committed violence actions on them, and their significant others have emotionally or physically abused them, and that we're there teaching them about healthy relationships.
Well, Emilio, thank you so much for calling, and thank you for your work on this. And Cody, you're sitting here smiling. Clearly, this is exactly what you're hoping will happen.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Emilio's part of our statewide teen council. So thank you for calling in.
And before we run out of time, I want to make sure that adults and teens know where they can get more information about the Dare to Know project, but also just about healthy relationships. What are some resources, Cody, that you would point them to?
Our website, we have a Get Help section that has the domestic violence programs throughout all 72 counties in Wisconsin. For dating violence, there's loveisrespect.org, and has just an amazing array of teen-focused, teen-created materials around dating violence.
And those are actually safe to visit, and you can visit without there being a trace in your browser, I believe.
There's a safe exit.
Safe exit. Yeah. Great. Well, Stephanie and Cody, thank you so much for joining us today. Really important information.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
That was Stephanie Ortiz and Cody Warner, both from End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. We were talking about the problem of teen dating violence and what's being done here in the state to prevent it. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election has been released. The document is 448 pages long and includes color-coded redactions with explanations behind each one. In a statement this morning, Attorney General William Barr said there was no cooperation between President Trump and the Russians.
After nearly 2 years of investigation, thousands of subpoenas, hundreds of warrants, and witness interviews, the special counsel confirmed that the Russian government sponsored efforts to illegally interfere with the 2016 presidential election, but did not find that the Trump campaign or other Americans colluded in those efforts.
While the report shows no evidence of collusion, it did say that Trump tried to sideline some key players, but that there's not enough proof that he obstructed justice. Democrats are calling foul on the way the report was released and want Mueller to testify before Congress in the next few weeks. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor and chair of the political science department at Marquette University and has been following all of this from the start. Lowell, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Judith. Welcome to good to be with you.
and welcome to Mueller Day, I think is probably where you were going.
Yeah, there we go.
Today's remarks by Attorney General Barr, along with the release of the Mueller report, seem to line up with the summary that Barr offered last month. Did you see any big conflicts between the two?
Well, I think clearly the Democrats are very concerned that, in fact, there's a lot of details in the report that didn't line up with the initial letter and maybe in some ways didn't sort of neatly line up even with the statement Barr made today. I think there is evidence of certainly a lot of cooperation and I would argue in a way collusion in the sense of just two sides working together without that direct connection in a way that, you know, Mueller really had a very high bar for that. So it really is in some ways how we want to define collusion. There was not the level of criminal conspiracy, or Mueller even talks about not showing coordination, but that's because he has a very high standard for that in terms of having an agreement to cooperate as part of that. So I think there was certainly a lot of back and forth and a lot of following on the actions of others, but not something that Mueller felt comfortable and Barr certainly would agree, showing conspiracy.
So clearly, there's no way that any one person could have digested all 448 pages today. So we are not expecting that from you, Lowell. But, you know, from what you're reading and seeing and hearing, what is your takeaway from the investigation and the report?
I think two big takeaways. Maybe one is, again, the part of it on what the Russians did is very well spelled out by Mueller. Clearly, there was significant actions by Russia, and while it, again, may not have involved the kind of level of agreement to cooperate that would have led to charges of conspiracy, there was significant and effective actions by Russia. The second piece of it is that the obstruction part of the document is much more complicated and nuanced than I think Barr has been presenting. He said that he had determined the acts were not criminal obstruction and was very definitive about that. Mueller's own statements are much less definitive in the report, and I think as you read through that part, there are certainly a large number of actions that people would be quite concerned about in the obstruction section.
And so what is criminal obstruction, and why was that not a bar that could be met?
Well, one of the ways that it's defined, and this is actually laid out in the text of the report, is that there has to be an act, and that act has to be connected to some kind of potential action that could happen to the person, so charges or something like that. It has to have been contemplated to sort of have an impact, and then it needs to have some kind of corrupt intent behind it. And so there's a lot of things that have to happen. And even with that high bar, what we really got from Mueller is him saying we don't have a clear-cut case for charging with charging obstruction, but here is the evidence that people could look at. And so there's a lot of details about those different incidences that were investigated as examples of possible obstruction.
Here's Attorney General Barr from this morning's statement talking about the obstruction issue.
After carefully reviewing the facts and legal theories outlined in the report and in consultation with the Office of Legal Counsel and other department lawyers, the Deputy Attorney General and I concluded that the evidence developed by the special counsel is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense.
Now, Lowell, the report specifically said that President Trump is not exonerated. It did say that it did not have enough to charge with obstruction. How does this play for President Trump? Does it damage him? Does he emerge unscathed? There's somewhere in between.
Oh, I think this was a good day politically for him, particularly because of Barr's efforts to frame the report before it came out. So a lot of people saw the ways that it was portrayed by Barr and therefore may not have paid quite as much attention to the details once it came out. As I think in that aspect, it is a good day for Trump. And again, in a general way, it also is in that it does show certainly much less coordination and perhaps even many fewer efforts to obstruct than some people might have thought were actually going on. So in some ways, again, I think it's a good day overall. But I would be careful if I were the White House and getting too excited about today, because, again, if you start reading through the details of the obstruction sections, they lay out in those things that I was talking about before, about whether there was a particular act and whether it was something that, again, that had criminal or corrupt intent, and that whether there was kind of contemplation about the impact, all that. They walk through all those, and in a lot of these instances, many of them, I would read the wording to say were cleared in terms of that bar. I mean, they actually got above that. And the other thing is that in a lot of cases, either the issue was a kind of lack of full evidentiary support. So it was not that there wasn't evidence, it was just there wasn't enough evidence to make Mueller feel comfortable that we have reached that standard. And in some cases, in a lot of ways, to be honest, the president may have been saved by his own aides refusing to follow through on orders. Because when they did not act in ways that he had requested them to, in some cases, that may have saved him from essentially there not really being an act. There was a request, but not an actual act of obstruction.
We're talking with Lowell Barrington. He's associate professor of political science at Marquette University, talking about the release of the redacted but full Mueller report today. And let's go to the phones, and Cole in Sun Prairie is up first. Hi, Cole.
Hi. So I have a couple of comments that I just want to say. I think I have to thoroughly disagree with your guest on the interpretation of the report, saying that Mueller didn't find enough evidence that was a conclusion, because the way that I read it was that there were multiple points, 10-plus points of obstruction of justice pointed out that that Mueller emphatically it pointed out to Congress that it was within their responsibilities and their right to hold the president accountable for those cases of obstruction of justice. And it's interesting because your guest points out that, you know, his aides might have saved him by not carrying out orders. Well, those orders in and of themselves should meet a level of obstruction that Congress should hold up. And my last point is that when we talk about the supposed absolution of collusion, I would again completely disagree with that. As in the Mueller, in this report, there are multiple outlines for criminal conspiracy, least of which that seems to be forgotten is Manafort's handing over of political polling data to the Russians. And if that's not conspiracy to collude, I don't know what is. And I guess I wouldn't mind hearing your guest's take on that specific point there.
Great. Thanks for that comment and question, Cole. Lowell, how would you respond?
Well, I actually think we're not as different in our views as Cole thought we were. I did say, in fact, that I personally think the report does show collusion. I have a different take on what that means, perhaps, than some people on the right, or even maybe Attorney General Barr do, in the sense if we're talking about two sides working together and perhaps sometimes through a third party like WikiLeaks, there clearly are examples of collusion. The polling question, by the way, is a very interesting one, because again, the question is, was there evidence that anything was done with that? That it's not illegal for somebody in the campaign to give somebody internal polling data. It's not the normal thing that happens, but that alone isn't the question. The question was if that was done in a coordinated way to have particular kinds of targeting done as a result, and if that crossed some threshold of illegality, then there would be an issue. I know, in fact, Mueller looked at that topic. I think the question, or one of the questions, is what was done with those polling data, and if we can't establish that, it's hard to probably say there was an actual criminal act in that case.
Lowell, let's spend just a couple minutes talking about what was redacted and why. What were the reasons that were given for eliminating some of the information from the report before it was released?
Well, first of all, I'll say it's very interesting reading through, because there sometimes are page after page after page of no redactions, and then there are very heavily redacted sections where entire pages are blacked out. So as somebody is reading through it, again, it's interesting to try to make sense of where there were redactions and where there weren't. But we do have basically four categories of redactions. So the grand jury testimony, and essentially everyone would agree with this, needs to be redacted. The methods of intelligence gathering, again, I think pretty much everyone would agree that that's something we want redacted from a public report, because we don't want to compromise our intelligence community and their efforts to collect evidence about what foreign governments are doing to harm us. So that was redacted. The potential harm to sort of personal privacy for people who were connected but perhaps a little bit peripherally or on the edge of things, that one's a little dicier to me. I mean, in the sense that where the line is of where their privacy is threatened and how innocent someone has to be in a way for the redaction to come into play is a lot less clear than the other ones. So that's an interesting one. The one that, as you read through, is everywhere in a way. And in fact, Barr this morning said ahead of time, this is far more than the others, the thing that led to redactions, was a harm to ongoing investigations. And again, I would say most people would agree for the need for that kind of information to be redacted. You don't want to compromise witnesses, figuring out things and changing their stories or something like that. You wouldn't want that evidence out if there's an ongoing investigation, but it certainly signals the huge number of ongoing points of contention that Mueller either did not resolve or passed on. And there is reference to 14 investigations of information that Mueller referred to those investigations as opposed to handling himself. That, again, is one of those points that I would say why the White House needs to be a little careful about celebrating too hard today.
We're talking with Lowell Barrington about today's release of the Mueller report and what happens now. He's an associate professor and chair of the political science department at Marquette University. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the Mueller report or Attorney General William Barr's announcement? Has your opinion changed now that the full but redacted report is out? And should this be the end of the story, or are there still questions that need to be answered? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
And they're having a good day. I'm having a good day, too. It was called No Collusion, No Obstruction.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. That was President Trump during an event today for wounded warriors reacting to the much-anticipated release of the Mueller report. It said there was no collusion between the Trump campaign or any other U.S. citizen and the Russian government. It also found no evidence of obstruction, though it said it does not exonerate President Trump either. Lowell Barrington is our guest. He's an associate professor and chair of the political science department at Marquette University and has been following the Mueller investigation closely. And you can weigh in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What stands out most to you about the Mueller report? Are you convinced that President Trump is in the clear, or do some of the details seem questionable to you? What do you want to see happen next? Do you agree with the president that those who launched the investigation should now be investigated themselves? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Lowell, Democrats are criticizing Barr's performance this morning. They say he was wrong to hold a press briefing before the public release of the report and accused him of conducting a campaign event for President Trump. Here's House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler.
Attorney General Barr appears to have shown an unsettling willingness to undermine his own department in order to protect President Trump. Barr's words and actions suggest he has been disingenuous and misleading in saying the president is clear of wrongdoing.
And Lowell, what's your take on Attorney General Barr's presentation today?
Well, I would not go as far as to say it was a campaign speech, but it certainly, again, echoed in a lot of ways the initial letter that he sent out, including, again, using language that the White House has used on this in a way that he didn't have to do. So it's interesting that he chose to do that. I think the other thing, that there were some statements that just frankly are flat wrong that he made, and including basically saying that the president fully cooperated with the special counsel. And that's just not true. If you read the report in terms of the written statements the president gave were not considered fully informative and cooperative and helpful. And on top of that, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, the decision was made not to force the president to testify in person only because it would have delayed the investigation for such a long time, because the White House would have simply refused to do that, and it would have been sent to the courts, and it would have been probably another year to 2 years of delay before it's ultimately resolved. And so that was part of the calculation, I believe, for the special counsel. But this was not a case of a president who was fully cooperating in every way. And again, going back to the obstruction section, it's clearly a case of a president not fully cooperating in every way, even if we do not end up with charges of obstruction out of this from the special counsel.
Let's go back to the phones, and Mike in Madison is up. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I think our biggest concern is we spent all this time playing partisan politics and pitting citizen against citizen that we've forgotten the real issue that started all of this, which is Russia manipulated our social media and hacked our election, and it's now been over 2 years, and we have done nothing about it at all.
Thanks for that comment, Mike. Lowell?
I agree strongly with Mike in a lot of ways. I think there's more to it just than that, and I'll come back to that in a second. But clearly the central part of this in the first place was really to highlight what Russia did. And this is something that, in fact, should unify us in that it is something that's not in dispute by Democrats or Republicans. It's not in dispute in the report. And, in fact, the report details, in some cases really with painful detail in a lot of ways in terms of how specified it is, about what Russia did and the efforts that it was taking. So I think that Mike is absolutely right. We need to not only always have that in mind, but to be thinking about it as we move forward to future elections, that Russia learns from things it does in the past and then and takes new takes on it the next time. And they are already learning from what we have discovered about what they did to try to do new things. And that is something we need to be ready for. I would say there are things that we do need to have more detail about. And back to actually a point that Cole made before about that Mueller specifically mentioned that Congress has a role or at least has a right to have a role here on the question of obstruction. And I think that's a really important point because, again, what Mueller said about obstruction was that there are difficult issues that need to be resolved if there was going to be a kind of traditional prosecutorial judgment was the wording he used. And basically what he was saying is we weren't going to resolve those quickly right now, but then really came down and said, but in fact, this is the kind of thing that Congress could look at. And again, that he's also saying it does not exonerate the president at this point to not charge him. So I think there's a lot we still need to look at and take from this beyond the Russia involvement. But I also really agree with Mike. We need to not forget what Russia has done and is continuing to do and will continue to try to do.
We're running a little short on time, but a listener, Tony in Pardeeville, said that if anything illegal had happened, we would have gotten that information by now. Would you agree that at this point, Lowell, there's nothing to see?
I wouldn't say it that way. I think that, again, on certain things based on the standards that were laid out, I think we would agree that on the things laid out in the report that there were not criminal charges made. But again, there's a role for further investigations from Congress on obstruction. And again, the other thing about that statement is that when Mueller himself has referred information to 14 different investigations, and that's only ones that he referred to. So that's not the additional ones that have been developed on their own without his assistance. There clearly is a lot of investigations still to come on possible criminal action. And as you know, we've been talking about for a very long time in our different conversations that financial crimes from the start were a concern for me. And I think that that is an area that, again, Mueller did not mention in the report in any significant way at all. And I'm sure that is at least a part of those 14 investigations.
I believe Attorney General Barr is expected to appear before Congress. I know that Democrats in Congress also want to hear directly from Robert Mueller. It does not seem like today's release is the end of the story, Lowell.
No, I don't think so. And I actually think Mueller testifying would be a good thing down the road. And I think it may not happen immediately. I would imagine it may happen once he steps back from his position and is away from the Justice Department for a little while. But clearly, it's important to see how he characterizes the report and perhaps also how he characterizes Barr and his handling of the report.
Well, Lowell, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Judith.
Lowell Barrington is an associate professor and chair of the Political Science Department at Marquette University. We talked with him about the release of the redacted but full Mueller report today. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, former oil and gas lobbyist David Bernhardt has been confirmed to lead the U.S. Interior Department. We'll find out who he is and what his priorities are. And few things are tastier than a grilled cheese sandwich. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we'll talk about how to make a great one and some tasty variations.